Session number 16808, Rule 26.
Race Tittle's Rule 26.
No, so, you know, they get a bit jittery through being in action for a prolonged period, and you reach a stage which was commonly referred to amongst the lads as bomb apping. And if it's taken in time, of course, you can sort of get by it. And I had the suspicion that this major, I mean, he'd done his whack, as I say, had given this job, which was a responsible job, it also meant that he was having a rest. And, I mean, these people, when they get into this stage, if they're pressed on and keep on, they can become very irrational in their thinking and movements. And from a tank man's point of view, they become unstable as regards doing an efficient job, you see. They become a danger to themselves and other people. So, but if they're kept in too long, the nerve goes and they just become what they call technically bomb happy, you see. They have to go to hospital and that's it. So, without apparently being injured in any way, they become a casualty. And they try to protect them, you see. But anyway, this Reamy blokes, he said, your tank will be ready tomorrow. So he said, if you go over and see Tashi, he said, you'll get your crew for it. Now, my intention was to go across and see him. But before that happened, he came to see me. And he said, Corbett, he said, now, we've had that Sherman 17-pounder brought up today, which they had, you see, a 17-pounder Sherman. And he said, they need that up the regiment. So he said, tomorrow I'll get you some sort of a crew. He said, you can take that up. I said, what? You mean tank commander? Yes, he said, you're a tank commander. He said, you can take that up, you see. So I said, well, I've never been in a Sherman. I mean, I had only twice when I drove those two up from the beach. I didn't class that as being in a Sherman. So I said, I've never been in a Sherman. He said, it's a tank. I said, I know that, sir. I said, but all my training has been done in Cromwells. I said, I know I can work in a Cromwell blindfolded. I said, I don't know the first thing about a Sherman, let alone a 17-pounder. I said, I don't know what you can do with a 17-pounder. I mean, you've got to know the quality of your gun. You've got to know what its capabilities are. You know what you've got to do with it. And with a Sherman, the size of it, the displacement of the wheelbase and all that, you've got to know what situation you can take it in without getting bogged down or turn it over or whatever. You know, you've got to be able to appreciate the ground situation in relationship to the capabilities of your tank. And I said, no, I said, I'll be useless, I said, in a 17-pounder Sherman. And of course, there was another thing in the back of my mind that I knew from experience right from the first days, that a 17-pounder Sherman is the first tank that the Germans knocked out. So I thought, well, that's not going to be very good for a long life anyway. So there was two reasons why I did no intentions of going in that Sherman. So he said, Corporal, he said, you'll take that Sherman up tomorrow, you'll have a crew, and it's got to go to the regiment. So I said, well, I said, I don't know how to refuse. So I said, he said, if you refuse, you're disobeying an order. He said, I shall put you under guard. I said, yeah, that's what I mean. So I said, yeah, all right, sir. I said, we'll leave it at that then. The understanding being that I would, he'd get a crew and I would take it up, you see. And I thought, well, I don't know. You know, because if I'd have directly refused, I'd have been in the guard room, you see. I'd have been done straight away. So I was in between the devil and deep blue sea, really. Anyway, I had to go down to the MO for my dressings that evening, and I went in. I said, I'm in a bit of a pickle. So he said, because we've become quite matey, like, you see. I said, I'm in a bit of a pickle. So he said, why? So I told him, you see. So he said, oh, well, he said, I'll have a word with him, he said. You wasn't going to go back tomorrow, even with your Cromwell. He said, you're not ready yet. That, he meant that by my dressings, you see. He said, you wasn't going to go back tomorrow anyway. Because in the morning, I told him in the morning what the Remy told me. They said, your tank will be ready, you see. And in conversation, I told him in the morning, you see. I said, the tank will be ready tomorrow. I And he never said nothing because he knew he'd be seeing me again later in the day. So when I told him about the other business, he said, I'll have a word, he said, because you're not going to go back anyway, not yet. He said, not even with that. So he said, he'll have to find a bloke for that, to crew that, you see. And of course, he was short of tank commanders. You can generally find crews, but tank commanders were becoming a bit of a problem, like you see. And although they were sticking people in who were not trained as tank commanders, it wasn't so good as having an efficient tank commander. And so, anyway, he done me dressings and I went back to my tank with old Bill Barnett. And a bit later on, a runner came up and he said that, the MO sent me up, he said, get your small kit and get down the MO room. I said the MO room, it was only a tent really. So I said, well, what's he said, I don't know, he said, he just told me to get your small kit and get down the MO room. So I got me, you know, my shaving kit, and all me, just my small kit, you see. And went down, and he said, right, he said, here's a letter. I forget now what number into the hospital was. He said, here's a letter. He said, I'll take you down in the truck. He said, and you're reporting down there, and the letter in. He said, no, I'll deal with you. So I said, oh, right. So I goes down there, you see. And while I was there, whatever was in the letter, they gave me an eye test and found that I needed glasses, you see. Well, I'd always had, like, 20/20 vision, but I put it down to the fact that using binoculars as a tank commander all those years had done my eyes in, you know, the muscles of my eyes. And although I wasn't aware of it, I mean, even now, if I take my glasses off, I can read a number plate across the road. But then you get further than that. I mean, if I took my glasses off fishing, I'd have a job to see me float, you know, because it's so small. Whereas normally, put them on, I'd see it plain as a pike staff, you see. But that was a situation I wasn't aware of, because if I looked, and without thinking, I thought, oh, I've used my glasses. And it never occurred to me that I was using my glasses at distances that I ought not to be using my glasses, you know, because it was so familiar with you. So I wasn't aware that my eyes had deteriorated. So I was fixed up with glasses, you see. And I've never got in the habit of wearing them because I felt, you know, I could read and write and all that, but it was the distance, you see. So anyway, that was one of the things. And of course, when I got to this hospital, I was still having dressings every day, me doing my dressings. And there was only a few chaps there in this hospital, in this ward apart place, you know, there's a room with the beds in, double bunk beds. And there's about four or five blokes in there. Room for about 30, you see. And I didn't know them. And they had been there together some time and knew each other. And I was a stranger coming in, you see, so I just, oh, hello, mate, you know, and all that and the other. And I just sort of became detached, as you might say. I didn't sort of push in any way, like, you know. And after two or three days, the MO had me in, because I was having dressings with the orderly. And after two or three days, the MO had me in, and he said, you don't seem to be getting on very well with the other chaps, apparently. So I said, yeah, all right. No, he said, I mean, you don't seem to be mixing. I said, well, what's funny about that? You know, I said, I don't know them. They were all from different units. I just don't know them. He said, yes, but you've apparently made no attempt to get in conversation, to sort of get to know them, like, you know. I said, well, I'm quite happy about that. He said, well, I'm not. He said, anyway, I'm going to send you down to another hospital. So he sent me back down, and we went into it was a wing, actually, of a sort of a nun. There were nuns and that there, you know. It was a monastery or some, or basilica, do they call them out there, basilicas or something. But anyway, it was a dormitory, a large dormitory of this place anyway, and the nuns were there, but they turned it into a hospital, you see. And what they got there was people who were wounded, but they were not there particularly for being wounded. It wasn't like a casualty clearing place, you see. And it transpired that they were there more for being mental, bomb happy, rather than physical damage, you see. And this bloke sent me there simply because I didn't seem to get talking with these blokes, you see. And of course, when I first go back, I mean, Indian services, you get used to sort of taking everything in your stride. If anything happens, you just go and you, that's it, you know, it's there. Yesterday's yesterday, today's today. Till tomorrow comes, you see. So it never occurred to me, you see, initially. Then I suddenly realised there's blokes there who can't speak, they stutter, and they're a bit unstable, and this, that, and the other. And in no time at all, there was a week gone by, you see. And every day I'm having my dresses, and there's little bits of the shrapnel keep working their way up to your skin, so they get a pair of tweezers and pick them out, and put some iodine on or something, you know, and sticky plaster. But gradually that's all going, you see. And I'm coming to the point where I don't really need dressings. But I'm still in the hospital. And every other day I'm going down to have an interview with this Major Munns. I've never forgotten him, Major Munns, that was a nice chap. And he's a psychiatrist at this hospital. And it was talking with him that made me realise that probably if I'd have stayed in action longer, I would have been a bomb happy case. Because he got all my history there, he knew my background, what I'd been through, where I'd been wounded and what had happened and all that. And he'd gone into the details of the actions that I'd fought in, to the point of, you know, Epsom being a bad one, Goodwood being a bad one, and Bluecoat being a bad one. And he got all that information, and he was talking to me about it, and it's strange, he talked, and he virtually reduced it to tears. And when I sort of went in to see him another time, when I was perfectly composed, I said to him about this business of, you know, I said, what's the point of you keep upsetting me? You know, I mean, that's what he was doing. And he said, you're on the verge. He said, and the only way to put it right is to get it out. And the only way to get it out is to talk about it. Bring it all back. He said, that's what we do. We talk about it. I said, yeah, I know. I said, it upsets you. Well, that's what it's for, he said. He said, you don't want to be like some of the other chaps who are unfortunate enough to have, they've kept them on too long, he said. And they're really bad cases. So anyway, the weeks went on and time went on. I was in there for about, I suppose, a couple of months or more. Doing nothing. And apparently become physically fit. But he was reluctant to let me go yet. But it comes a point where other authorities probably tell him it's time I was moved. And so you have to have a treatment to sort, you know, sort the system out. And they had three methods there. And we become familiar with all of them. And they become a joke to us, you see. And strangely enough, after I'd left and all this had happened, and I finished up in this hospital, a few weeks after I'd been in there, Taffy Ellis and Jack Mitchell, who was a wireless operator in one of the other tanks, they came in the same hospital. And Jack was bomb happy as a coot. He stuttered, not, you know, couldn't keep a limb still. And Taffy was stone deaf. It had a shell, it hit the side of his turret with a shell, and it hadn't penetrated. But what used to happen, if you got a tank hit, I mean, I never experienced it, but I knew what happened. If you got a ricochet, a heavy ricochet on a turret, it used to go sort of red hot or white hot, and then instantly go black when the heat went out of it, you see. But the impact inside, he'd gone deaf, they'd pierced his eardrums. You know, the vacuum of the impact, it creates a vacuum. and he'd gone deaf. So Taffy was totally deaf and a bit shaky, and poor old Jack was all sort of right bum happy. And they had come to the same hospital while I was there, you see. So there was the three of us together, and of course I said to Jack, so what happened then, you see? He said, it's bloody funny, he said. Old Taffy said, no, old Reggie's gone. He said, we're going to get in trouble, you can bet on that. He said, they gave us a bloody Sherman, didn't they, he said. And after I'd gone, the whole troop got brewed up. They got wiped out. Not all killed, but I mean, they got all knocked out, you see. And we had a laugh. I said, well, I was looking after it, wasn't I? You know. But anyway, this happened while I was in the hospital. But eventually, it was the same Agemons had me down, and he said, now, he said, we're going to give you some treatment, he said, because you've got to go for assessment. He said, now, you know what you can have? You can either have electrical shock treatment, you can have hypnosis treatment, or you can go in the jungle ward. And this jungle ward, it's like you see in fantasy fiction. They go in this ward and they give you an injection, and it puts you in a semi mental state where you know you're alive, you're aware of what's going on around you, but you can't move. You just lie there. And we called it the jungle ward, you see. Now, you had to go to the toilet and things like that. So I used to have two of the ward orderlies used to take you to the toilet, you see, and bring you back and put you back on the bed. And then, according to the depth of your circumstances, I suppose you might use the word, they used to bring you round and the major would talk to you. Again, it was an in-depth means of getting to your brain, to their mind, to your system. Deeper than what it would do talking verbally while you were conscious, you see. And so he said, now those are the three options, right? He said, now what would you like to do? So I said, well, what do you think? I said, you know what you're doing. You know me better than I know me, you see. He said, well, I think either of the electrical or hypnosis would be sufficient. I said, you don't think I need to go to jungle ward then? He said, if you want to go in the jungle ward, you can. That's entirely up to you. I said, so the thing is, I said, we want to get this done, don't we, proper? He said, yes. I said, well, put me in a jungle ward then. So, you know, that was obviously a more in-depth treatment, I thought, than the other two, you see. So he said, all right, we'll put you in a jungle ward. And he used to go in for 3 days. So I went in the jungle ward, you see. It was always a joke amongst the lads. And when you come out and you'd recovered from that, you got it out of your system, you come back, and you was apparently normal. Of course, you used to go down and go, ho, 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 you know, because you've been in the jungle ward, making out it was a bit of an ape or something. And it'd become a joke. You could all tell the lads who'd been in the jungle ward, because they used to go around and every little while, because you were always creating humour in the forces. You also had to have humour. I mean, to explain it to a civilian today, they think, oh, bloody waste of time. But it was humorous at the time in the circumstances, you see. So you get these lads, and when they come out of the jungle ward, they'd still be in the hospital for a bit longer before they went for assessment, you see. And so they come down and say, you're all right now, eh? So, you know, and so it's all right. The new blokes wonder what was happening, you see. So it's always been in the jungle ward. And it was comical, really. And the funny thing was, I had a lad in the next bed to me in this dormitory, and he was from the Dutch Princess Irene, I think what that was called, Princess Irene. And he got this triangular, yellowy-coloured, brownie-coloured badge on his shoulder. And he was a very young man, young to me, he was only about 19. And I got talking to him, and it was a real bum-happy case. And apparently, and I told him about it, and I was knocked out at a approach at Sertogenbosch, and he said, I was actually in Sertogenbosch when he got wounded. And he said, I could see my house where I lived. He said, and that's why I got wounded, he said, because I tried to get to my house. He said, and he got wounded, like you say, and then he finished up in this hospital recovering from his wounds, and also because his nerve had gone, you see. And near this hospital, as I referred to it, it wasn't a hospital, it was a dormitory part of something else, they got some American 5.5s, these .55 guns, almost like an AK gun, you see. And we were directly in line for these flying bombs, which they were still using. And when they used to come over, it was stupid. You'd have thought somebody from the hospital would have went and had them moved, because they were in between the direction that these flying bombs came from and us, you see. So as these flying bombs approached, these firefighters are banging away at them, bang, bang, and you got these flying bombs coming over. And if they'd have hit them, I mean, they'd have probably dropped on this hospital place, like. You'd have thought they should have put on the other side so that the flying bombs had actually gone over before they fired at them. And of course, as soon as they started cracking away, at night, they still done it at night, you see, you could see the flame coming out the back of them, you see, so they got a target to fire at. And this lad, they used to put all the lights dimmed, all the lights, you see, and the blackouts and everything, you see. But as soon as they come over, the nurses used to come round and station themselves round in case anybody could put, and he was a gone. He used to be out of his bed, and he used to go straight down the cellars and hide himself. And they used to go down and fetch him back, and he used to be apologising all the time. But he couldn't help it. As soon as they started, he'd gone, like a rocket. And he was the next bed. He was still there when I came out. Well, anyway, I eventually went for an assessment. And to us service blokes, I'd realised now, you're always ready to see a funny situation, as serious as it circumstances may be, you're always ready to see a funny situation. And we went down, and they gave us like a 20 questions to answer. Put questions and you put an answer to it, you see. Most of them were quite simple, and then they got a time. They used to time you how long it took you, you see. They'd be there and they'd sit there and they'd say, right, you've got your papers, right, as quick as you can. Think, and he was right there. Time's up, and they'd go around, pick all the papers up, you see, and they'd see how many had answered in that time and how correct they'd answered in that time. Because with the time factor, it pushed your mind to answer quick, so sometimes you perhaps put the wrong answer. And they told you, if you can't answer it, leave it, answer the next one, you know, and all that, you see. It was a purpose of assessment of your mind and your ability to mental state. And then they gave us these things like square blocks in round holes and all that sort of thing, you know. And bloke saying, hello, we're back, where's me nappy, you know, and all that sort of thing, because you can't charge things like, you know. And we went through this system of assessment, you see. And eventually they decided, from the medical reports, the psychiatry reports, and these reports of these tests, lasted all day, these tested. And from all this, they decided what grade you would be fit for further use to the services, you see. I mean, they didn't intend to discharge you, nothing like that. You just got to be reused in a capacity that you were fit for. Anyway, they graded me down to C1. And I went to see Major Bonds, and I said, they put me down to C1, Major. So he said, yes, that's right. He said, that was my, I'm afraid you've got to blame me for that. I said, why? He said, well, they was going to put you down to B1. So I said, and so what's the catch? He said, well, if they put you down to B1, you could have went back to the regiment. Not in a tank anymore. You'll never go back to fighting anymore. But B1, you could have went back to the regiment, and they would have used you in any capacity they felt you was useful. He said, but I know that because you were a tank commander, they would inevitably have put you back in a tank after they felt you'd been back with them long enough because of your capabilities. He said, no, I don't want that to happen. So he said, I told them I want you to be C1, but they were going to make you B1. So he said, this means that you cannot ever return to the regiment or any fighting capacity at all. You will become lines of communication, and you will be used in your trade as a driver mechanic somewhere in lines of communication. He said, I'm doing that, he said, because I think it's necessary. But, he said, I'm put a proviso in, and it's in my records, what I've got, when I did put in for a pension at one time, you see, and circumstance, and it came to an appeal of some sort, and I had to have all my history, army history, you see, which they sent me, and it states in there, you see, that the grade of C1, subject to a further medical examination after so many months, to be upgraded to B1, to return to his unit. And that's in my records. Well, he said to me, he told me this, you see, he said, now, the recommendation that in a few months' time, wherever you are, he said, you can apply for a medical request to be upgraded to B1. Then you're going to put an application in to rejoin your regiment. He said, and by then, he said, you may even be fit to go back in a tank. But he said, that will be up to the medical people on the ground at that time. He said, but initially, you will go into lines of communication in your capacity as a driver mechanic. And that's what happened, you see. Well, then I went through the system. We came out of the hospital, you see. Now we're getting up towards Christmas time, you see. I mean, this happened in first week in October when it all started. And incidentally, I would like to refer back at this moment, further to this premature shell and the court of inquiry, while I was with the tank, having been knocked out, you know, with this tank, and I was waiting for it to be rewired, and I was with the echelon, the Sergeant Major came down in his jeep, picked me up. He said, I've got to take you up to brigade, he said, because they're going to tell you the findings of the inquiry, you see. So he took me up to brigade, and the brigadier, he got a caravan, they all had caravans, like you see. So the Sergeant Major takes me up and goes up, taps the door. Said, the course goes outside, sir. He goes, expecting you, you see. So he said, right, it's on, mate, send him in. They didn't march me in, you see, just send him in. So I went in, saluted, and he said, yes, Corporal, he said, no. And he went through the rigmarole, he said, that the findings were that no blame attached whatever. The armourer's report was quite satisfactory, that it was simply a dud shell. But, he said, I don't like to think that you took away the services of an efficient officer. And of course, he was an old desert rat, you know, and I told you, they stick together like anything, you know. So he was very annoyed, the brigadier was. So he said, now I'm also to congratulate you, he's having disposed of that, you see. He said, I'm also to congratulate you, he said, on a very piece of Royal Tank Regiment discipline, in that, he said, I understand you recovered your tank under fire after having been wounded yourself. I said, yeah, that's more or less the case, so yes. He said, well, the Sergeant Major had put a recommendation in. So he said, I'm going to suggest that we tear that up. I said, whatever you say, sir. So that was that, you see. So I came out, and dismissed me, like, and I came out.
Tear what up?
This recommendation from the Sergeant Major, you see. And for recovering tank under fire type of thing. I mean, as far as I was concerned, it didn't matter, because, I mean, I knew it wasn't an unusual thing. You know, I mean, in Normandy especially, those things went on. You know, people would have had Victoria Crosses, some of them. But anyway, I came out and got in the jeep, and we started back. And he said, how'd you get on? I said, oh, all right. I said, it was a foregone conclusion, wasn't it? I said, I mean, good show, wasn't it? No, he said, about the other business. Oh, I said, he thought we ought to tear that up. And Sergeant Major was furious. And so that was that, anyway. So that was the nearest I ever get to a possibility of a mention in dispatches or something. But anyway, that was that, you see. Anyway, so I gets down to C1 grade and were discharged from the hospital. And I went to a holding unit which was in more or less some garages in a village called Zeelandium, which is just outside, well, just outside, it's probably about 8 or 10 miles from Bruges. And I'm not quite sure now whether I spent Christmas there or in Bruges. I think it was in Bruges. But then initially I went to this village.